So I'm David Dagan from Georgia Tech, and I was asked to put together some slides and told around the range of 15 minutes or so. So, of course, I made about 40 or 50, as union regulations require. In the following slides, I'm going to talk a little bit about the DNS exploit in a abstract sense. It is still, in some sense, not completely public, although there are implementations in the wild. And said I want to make sure that people understand conceptually how it works and how it is a game changer for DNS. And I'd also like to occasionally offer some suggestions. I think now more than ever the talents of this research community are needed. And I will occasionally point out in some of the slides in red where I think there's an interesting problem that could be answered by this community. So if you're looking for things to do, if you're idle or bored, this is your window. So traditional, basic, sort of pre-Kaminsky class poisoning, and to some extent, you know, post-Kaminsky largely works this way, and is that we have essentially three parties to a query, where you have a stub resolver, a recursive server, and the authority. You can think of the stub resolver as a non-caching resolver initiator that's on your desktop, on your notebook. It doesn't know much more than where to reach the recursor. The recursor is a full resolver. It understands the hierarchy of DNS, understands how zones are cut, understands where to find authorities. And the authority server is ultimately the DNS server that is responsible for a particular delegation. And I've omitted on the right-hand side the hierarchy of DNS that you often see in those sort of introductory overviews, so that we just have really essentially two parties we really care about in this DNS poisoning scenario. One is the recursive in the center asking a question, and then the authority. The attacker, of course, would like to get involved in this race and will be sending answers. DNS transactions up until fairly recently were uniquely identified by a transaction ID field, 16 bits. And that seems quite small for those of you who do security work, cryptography, and I'll explain why we didn't have this problem, you know, years and years ago. Well, of course, the goal of the attacker is to certainly guess the ID field by sending multiple packets, and there's a bit of a race that goes on between the correct answer and the forged, spoofed answers. Well, you can think of this conceptually over time. There's a window of attack that you have, and each packet that you're able to send during that window when the DNS server is waiting for the authority to answer improves your overall cumulative probability of successfully attacking a DNS server. So each packet you're able to send during that brief window improves your overall chance of success. And if you have 65,000 possible values in the QID field and there's not much more entropy lying around in terms of source IPs or destination IPs based on the multi-home nature of authorities or recursors, it's a fairly small space. Well, why this worked before is that, as it turns out, the window of opportunity was measured in milliseconds. 100 milliseconds is a fairly average RTT time. They can be shorter. There's local minima, local maxima. It all certainly depends on where you are and where the authority is. But 100 milliseconds is a good rule of thumb. And if you don't successfully guess in that attack window, you have to essentially wait for that correct answer to time out of cache. Now, nowadays, those TTLs can be fairly short with agile content distribution networks, the Akamai's, the CNN-type distribution networks. But largely, these TTLs are measured in days. And so if there wasn't success immediately, you had to wait a very long period of time. And so that's why 16 bits was fine up until recently. Dan Kaminsky announced an innovative way to perform cache poisoning that takes place in seconds. I believe that Dan at the time was saying it's 11 seconds or something on that order. I think there was a public demonstration of something that happened in 7 or 6 seconds, and the sub-millisecond range is being discussed and anecdotally observed as well in some implementations. So this is clearly quite different from what we had faced before. Let me give you some of the overarching points that are important to understand about this class and why it makes things different. You can start the attack anytime. If there already is a cache entry that you don't like and want to replace as the attacker, you don't have to wait for it to time out and then use that as your opportunity to force the DNS initiator to query again and open its window. You can just go ahead and start attacking. There's no penalty if you fail to successfully attack during that brief window. You can start again and again over and over. That's sort of a corollary of the first point that's made about this attack. The attack is essentially, in that case, only bandwidth limited. You simply need to send a lot of packets, and many networks can, botnets in particular. It's a deterministic march to cache manipulation, takes place in seconds, an efficient killing machine. And I would urge you to either attend Dan Kaminsky's talk at the upcoming Black Hat or look at the materials he prepares for that so that you get a better sense of how that works and why. But these are the properties that I'd like you to have in mind about this particular new form of DNS poisoning. Here are some of the players that are involved here, and this might help suggest some research opportunities for people who are interested in getting involved in this type of work. We have here the recursive server who was somehow induced to initiate a query up to the authority asking about some label, let's say, in example.com, and then the attacker below will be sending out spoofed answers, lots of them, with the source address for those answers of the authority server, so they are, you know, otherwise convincingly the correct answer, except for some of the QIDs may not match. And eventually they will, given enough time. Now, given that Dan's attack works fairly deterministically for 16-bit resolvers in seconds, this is an important aspect to understand in terms of the different players and who's involved. When we talk about DNS cache poisoning and its effects, what happens here is that the recursive will be induced to believe that the authority has changed, and then future queries from users will not be directed to the legitimate authority, but can be directed to the attacker's resources. Now, that's a very, very important point because certain players in this problem are looking at this and saying, well, we're fully patched. How come we have a problem? Let's take, for example, the green circle over there, the authority. They may be completely patched. The attack doesn't directly affect them, but it has implications for the zones that they manage because DNS recursors will no longer come to them necessarily if they've been poisoned. They may go elsewhere on the internet to resolve labels in that zone. So the authorities are essentially watching the distant war going on between attackers and recursives. And there's some interesting opportunities there that researchers can get involved in detecting those remote battles that are occurring between the attacker and the recursive. Users as well, I think, are always going to lose in these sorts of scenarios. They already were losing before because of some of the monetization that goes on in the alteration of DNS answers. But now the ability to alter records is quite trivially in the hands of anybody with just a modest amount of bandwidth. So the user in this case may be believing that they're getting the correct answer. And in terms of how they experience the attack, they don't necessarily see that the DNS cache has been corrupted. They simply start down a series of layer 7 interactions with the wrong authorities on the internet. So this actually includes a wide variety of other attacks. You know, phishing is one, you know, obvious, very direct application that comes from this. So I think it would be useful for the academic community to better characterize the different players that are involved and the risks that are posed to each of their interests. From the recursive point of view, there's the reputation of their DNS server, the integrity of the service they provide. The authority's risk is that visitors who were supposed to go to their domains are being sent elsewhere, and there's some sort of domain implications, brand implications for that. The user's risk, I think, is the most critical, and all DNS-aware applications now need to be rethought in terms of the assumptions they had made. So why is this an important exploit? Well, there's trivial exploits that can be built on top of this single vulnerability. Message interception, email redirection, essentially taking people's HTTP traffic and sending it to man-in-the-middle scenarios. There's numerous others, and I would urge you to see Dan Kaminsky's talk for more. And I think over the last few weeks, one of the realizations I've come to is that to some extent you do have to talk about a couple of potentially bad ideas so that people have that light bulb moment when they really realize, oh, that DNS server's cache really is important to me, because all of these other applications are going to depend upon it being correct. So I have an example. This is something that's being seen in the wild right now. So I think to some extent it may be acceptable to talk about in very general terms. In this particular diagram, we have two users who want to send email. They know each other through a trusted network, through work, and they may have a secure means of communication. But everybody you know through work has a Yahoo account or a Gmail account or some other account that they use when they're at home, when they're using their ISP for transit. And very often they may be trying to mail people at trusted domains and looking up the location of the mail server for those trusted domains using an ISP network or a cyber cafe or some other arbitrary DNS service. So in this particular case, we've posited that the person here in the middle of the slide is looking up the MX for a government unit, and the recursive server they're using has been affected, it's been poisoned, and the imposter has essentially become the startup authority for this. Instead of relying on the startup authority for the trusted network at the top of the slide, it's going to the imposter's network that they set up. And very directly, you will see then that the imposter will, of course, tell them that your mail for these networks no longer goes to this particular server. It will go to Russia or to some other proxy location. And there are a wide variety of behaviors that you may see, and it's an interesting exercise to think through what might be done and what you might observe and not observe in each of those scenarios. But everything from altering the mail to just keeping the mail or forwarding it unaltered are certainly very, very simple, easy, trivial possibilities. This is being observed now. At Georgia Tech, we've been probing DNS servers. And for those of you who operate AbuseAt, my apologies. You have been receiving a lot of packets from me and others. And you can see that there's been a rate of patching. This particular graph shows you that there's about 300,000 unique DNS servers probed. There's been a decrease in vulnerability to about 70% of that sample set. A lot of these represent dynamic addresses, hosts who are themselves in ISP space. These are people who are not providing DNS service to large numbers of users. So I think a research need is to understand the patch agility of networks, applications, and critical infrastructure services like DNS. We're all familiar with Patch Tuesday, and somebody decided that Tuesday was the right day. What's the right day for DNS? What's the right day for other applications? And how much time is needed to accomplish how much patching? These are, I think, profound questions that this community can help answer. I'll skip over this in the interest of getting further down. There's one particular thing we can learn from this by simply fingerprinting many of the DNS servers. We see popular versions of older DNS servers. Some of these are vulnerable now. Some of these need to be patched. Dan Kaminsky's tunnel is also visible there. I don't know that it's vulnerable, won't test it, but a research need is obviously how do we better characterize the quality of DNS services. You're all here at this hotel and are trusting that the services they provide are, in fact, not poisoned and altered. One other thing, this is I think, useful. Everybody's been asking, where are these DNS servers at? Where are they located that are vulnerable? Can we call them? Well, here's a pie graph. Every security talk that you've ever seen has a pie graph in it showing the country of origin, and this is that slide. I've often wondered what the takeaway is with this sort of level of analysis. I'll call my own version of this very shallow. I've seen some very effective uses of this analysis, but I think as a community, it would be very useful for us to provide actionable, insightful analysis of IP reputation systems. There is a paper here from SRI on just that for IP reputation. Extending that to DNS reputation would be, I think, intriguing, certainly better than just country code listings of where vulnerable services are found. You can't block France. That's not an acceptable answer these days. There are remedies. Port randomization is out. There are research needs and performance. Paul will probably talk about some of those. There are other research and remedies surrounding the encoding of state in the queue name. And I'll again skip over that. Maybe there'll be a question that will bring me back to these. But the The general way to summarize this problem is to say that there are too many lowercase letters on the internet, and that's the problem with DNS, and we're going to fix it by mixing it up a bit and making them random, upper and lowercase. And I'll tell you more about that if you're interested in implementation issues around this and want to help with that. In terms of the overall remedies here, I would ask you and your lab to consider these problems. We need to describe this new poisoning model more formally. I gave you some intuitions about, I think, interesting parameters that make it different, but this is obviously a new threat model that needs to be created, and the old taxonomies of threats probably need to be revisited to ask, was there an assumption in there based on the integrity of DNS that now needs to be revisited? I think in many cases, things like domain whitelistings are now seriously called into question, and so technologies that use that may need to be revised or refreshed or reconsidered. I think what's going to happen in 2 to 3 years, at least in the academic community, is a merging of IDS and DNS technologies. People who write IDS papers will write DNS papers. This is certainly happening right now as we speak in the industry, as the two areas of commerce begin to look at each other and realize they have mutual gain and mutual benefit. And I believe that overall, one of the larger problems is, how do you determine if a DNS answer is wrong if that's all you have? If you look something up right now with your notebook and you're given a number, exactly how would you go about determining that that is or is not associated with the domain that you were interested in finding? It's a profoundly difficult problem because the real-time nature of DNS requires that those answers be at your fingertips. There are engineering problems around the data collection as well. Paul will talk more about SIE and other monitoring, but if you're interested as an academic in any of those questions or questions I didn't think of, there are enormous amounts of data that can be found at ISC. They have a security information exchange environment where essentially you get to look at large amounts of DNS traffic. There are rules and restrictions on doing this, of course, but ISPs and universities who wish to contribute data may. There's a URL there. So, Paul?
All right, let's thank David. This one is good?
That's the one, only one I want to show.
Okay. So then you just leave it at that. Sorry, I didn't know that one was there.
Okay.
Hello. Thank you for staying late. So I agree with what David has said, and I will come back to what he said about SIE in a moment. Give you an idea about how we calibrate these things. We each had 15 minutes, so he brought 50 slides and went over time. I, on the other hand, used 2 slides when I spoke here the other day and also used 50 minutes. But this time I'm only going to do 1 slide, and hopefully it's the faster of the two. So we are randomizing UDP source ports, and if that makes you sort of think of children's toys that are easily broken, you'd be right. This is terrible. It is really ridiculous that we've got this global information infrastructure, which was found to be insecure in this way, and that this is how we chose to fix it. It's ridiculous, and we ought to be ashamed, and we are. This will not be the last UDP protocol where choosing a random UDP port is the only way to make it a little more secure. I can think of some things you could do to some other UDP protocols, but certainly anyone starting today would do either datagram TLS, or they would at least include a 64-bit random number that had to be echoed in the response rather than a 16-bit random number. You would also try to avoid, in a new UDP protocol that you did today, you would try to avoid letting someone induce you to make the same transaction over and over again so that you could expose the largest possible number of listeners. Oh, I think I broke it. Oh, there we go. Anyway, we're fixing it with UDP port randomization, and that is not going to be enough. It'll last this year, next couple years, but sooner or later somebody will come up with another trick like what Dan came up with this time. Probably, statistically speaking, it will be Dan, and it will be during Christmas time. However, the true fix, the right fix, is DNS security. That the IETF has been working on since the early 90s. To give you an idea about how it's going, we started that effort before IPv6 was begun. We are not as well deployed as IPv6 is now. We have declared victory four different times, the president standing in front of the banner, and been wrong each time. We are declaring victory at the moment, partly by redefining the mission to one that we can achieve. But there is something out there. If you get modern NSD from NLNet Labs, modern Unbound from NLNet Labs, modern Bind from us, you can have end-to-end security where you generate your signatures on one end, you validate them on the other end, and anything that happens in the middle is very easy to detect. The trouble is nobody knows what that means in terms of, well, okay, so if it's not right, what do? You repeat the question? Do you fail the mail or you refuse to visit the website? You know, what are you going to do if it doesn't validate? Because the API for DNS has never been able to signal maybe as an answer, and so the applications are not written with this in mind. Anyway, DNSSEC is, it's out there. It works really great in conference rooms full of laptops and pizza boxes. It could work worldwide if we could get ICANN to sign the route and like that. You should try it. You should learn about it. You should install validating resolvers. You should sign your zones. You should definitely do that, but it's not going to make any difference this year. We had to make a big difference this year. We had to use only the protocols that were currently on the wire and use the protocol agents that were currently deployed at the endpoints. And so we did what Dan Bernstein told us all those years ago that we should have done, which is to randomize the UDP source port of these DNS transactions. So in addition to the fact that this isn't really good enough for the ages, it's just getting us out of the current fire drill that we're in, it has some tremendous costs. It's hurting almost everybody who's doing it. I happen to be more aware than most of that pain because we shipped new versions of Bind that implement this, and we heard from all the people who tried to deploy those, and they said, did you know that it makes my kernel fall over and, you know, go boom? Or did you know that it makes my firewall fall over and go boom, and so on? So I've heard a lot of complaints, and I thought I would share some of those with you. I don't have the agenda that David has of trying to, you know, indicate what are interesting research areas by putting them in red. I think that you're probably smart enough to figure that out by listening to what I say, and if something piques your curiosity, please solve this problem. When you randomize ports, there are two general things you'll do. First, you'll increase your costs, and second, you'll miss some opportunities. Going through these as briefly as I can, because I don't want to go over time like David did. Firewalls generally have a little thing where they can keep some state, and if a packet goes in one direction, then a temporary rule is created that allows a corresponding sort of inverse packet to come back in the other direction, and that way you only need rules expressing one direction, and then the other ones are sort of automatically created for you. The trouble is that firewalls in general can only do this for a few dozen or at best a few hundred things at a time, and if you suddenly want to do it for tens of thousands of them at once, it will start discarding the older flows using LRU, even if the least recent use is in the milliseconds ago. So a lot of people have reported to us that DNS doesn't work if you do this behind a certain firewall, and we say, well, then maybe you need to get a different firewall or move your server outside your perimeter or whatever. We've also discovered that certain NAT boxes, such as all of them, except the ones from Checkpoint, will de-randomize your UDP port number for you for the next hop. So you do this really great RC4-based random number, and it gets out to the NAT, which creates a flow, and it allocates the next port number on the outside of its of the perimeter by incrementing some counter. This is bad. And you'd be shocked at some of the size of the companies who have six letters in their name and they run big internet things that are affected by this. So the vendors, and Dan admits that we should have thought more about this, because somebody mentioned this early on, and what we said is that can't be a problem. There's no way that, you know, these big, you know, Cisco, Juniper, and so forth firewalls would have that problem. Let's not waste time fixing that. That was a mistake. Firewalls that used to be able to let your name server talk on a fixed port now have to be told that your name server could be talking from any port. I'm sure you can all think of ways that that new openness in your firewall config can be abused. I mentioned that some kernels are willing to crash utterly if you have too many descriptors open or if your churn rate of opening and closing them is too high. And we're talking about some kernels that are sold to the finance industry and, you know, are not necessarily open source. They just couldn't cope. And, you know, so we're getting bug reports that our name server is making somebody's kernel panic. And, you know, that usually what ISC says in that case is maybe you need a different kernel. Sometimes that's not an option. You get port number collisions. You know, I love what the OpenBSD people have done as far as raising the bar. If you try to bind to UDP port 0 on most systems, it increments a number. And if that one's available, then that's the one you get. For OpenBSD, everything is RC4, not just the TCP initial sequence numbers and so forth, but everything. You bind to port 0, you're getting a random number, and that's great because that's an atomic operation. It's a system call. You can't get a collision. You know, by the time you're getting it and using it, nobody else could get it and use it. That's a beautiful thing. But they're the only ones doing it. So for us as an application author, we are getting a number from our own random number generator. We're not asking the kernel for port 0. We're asking it for some non-zero random number, and maybe it's available and maybe it's not. And if it's not, then you have to keep trying. And if you try a whole lot of times, then at some point you have to give up and fail and say, I'm sorry, I cannot get you a port number right now, so you just can't have an answer. There will be nothing but failure for you here. But on the other hand, if it's a port number that somebody else thought that they had just successfully negotiated with their other endpoint, which NTP is known to do, then it's possible you will take that port out from under it just as it is about to start trying to talk on it. And you can actually make other applications fail because you're iterating through these random numbers looking for one that you can get. Select really is intolerant of more than a couple dozen file descriptors. Certainly a couple 10,000 is a lot of things to be copying in and out of the kernel and then iterating through the resulting mask and then hoping that you'll get 100,000 queries per second through the resulting name server. Now, we've got ePoll, and we've got KQ, and we've got all sorts of things, but not every system has those, and so there are some computers out there that are going to be trying to run this code, and they're going to complain to us that we made bind slower, and I don't know what I'm going to tell them. 5 minutes. Okay. Cool. Now, there's also the problem, if somebody is attacking you, they're going to be hitting, you know, they might be choosing port numbers at random to guess. You as the name server won't know what they are because you don't have them all open. At least most people can't afford 60,000 descriptors. You have to stand there. Like with spam all over again, you just stand there. You're a fixed target. Your attacker can fade away into the jungle whenever they're done attacking you, but you just stand there until they come back and do it to you again, and you just have to take it. It's a statistical defense. Dan's analysis and, you know, David and other math types have agreed that this changes it. Using UDP port randomization will change it from a 10-second attack to a 10-hour or 2 or 3 day attack, but they can still get in if they're patient. So I hate stuff like that. Maybe there's an IDS that stops it before that happens, but maybe it's an unattended system. And last but not least, this is not a good end game. This is not the way I want my kids to inherit DNS. I would like to improve it further before we just sort of pour concrete around port randomization and say that that was good enough, because we know it's not. So I have come up with a whole bunch of different ways to increase the entropy of a DNS transaction. One of them came from Dagan, this uppercase, lowercase thing. Really cool idea, and I want to state again for the record, as I've done in public several times, he called me with this idea 3 days before Dan Kaminsky called me and told me that we had to do UDP port randomization, and here's why. So it's amazing that they were both thinking along similar lines, but in fact, his idea is not a response to the Kaminsky problem. It happens to be a very good response, but was not a reaction to it. But it's not enough, because maybe you don't have a long name. You know, in the internet draft that we wrote on this, we said that Disney.com was more secure than CIA.gov by this measure, because there are more letters to put random bits into in the longer names. So requiring that a minimum DNS name length is... that's not security either. So there's a lot of work being done on this on the name droppers mailing list. They just finished a great meeting in the IETF, just met in Dublin, and they were apparently sitting around the bar at night sort of having drinking games involving how fast they could infect each other's name servers, and the winner has got it down to 7 seconds, and I'm not sure exactly what they did because I wasn't there. But I don't have an alternative to UDP port randomization to offer you. I can tell you I've added a lot of stuff, and Dan can still drive a truck right through the name server that I've been doing the testing on. So you really do have to patch. You really do have to fix your firewalls and your kernels and all that stuff, and you really do. This is how we're going to live this year and probably next year. Hopefully the pain from UDP port randomization is going to lead all of us toward DNSSEC, which otherwise had no business model at all and was really difficult and had asymmetric cost benefit and a significant last mover advantage. But now, you know, the rising tide has swamped all boats, so here we are. So David mentioned the Security Information Exchange. I will answer more questions about that if there are any or at the reception tonight. But very briefly, you should be running a sensor. You should tell your IT departments that I would like to hear all of the response data they get from authority servers when they have a cache miss, because we will recreate the DNS one query at a time. If you're running an authority server, as many of you are, I also want to hear the queries, because I want to know what names are popular and who's making the queries, and especially I want to know how random their port numbers were. So you need to get home and run those sensors. If you're a researcher and you would like to see this data, you need to know that I am not hogging it. We have a LAN switch where we take all of the input from the sensors and we break it back out into packets and transmit it as layer 2 broadcast on various VLANs, depending on what type of data it was. And the people in my computer room, including these gentlemen, who have put computers there, are seeing it all in real time. There's no embargo. It's totally fair. You could have a machine there. If you're a commercial entity, you can still have a machine there, but you'll have to pay. If you're running sensors, you will pay less, but nevertheless, somebody's got to pay for this crud, as will be the people making money from it. It's carrying about 50 megabits of data. You can't take it home with you. That's one of the important rules. Whatever analysis you intend to do must be done in my rack. You will not take it back home and start your own security information exchange in your own data center, or otherwise risk the violation of the covenants I have signed with the sensor operators. Anyway, so that's the real brief overview of why I hate UDP port randomization and what the security information exchange is, and I'll shut up now.
I'll give you two choices. Either you can have flashback to John Postel in the 60s, what would you have done differently, or today, We're in a huge rat hole, and you are the czar of this whole damn thing, and you're going to drive DNSSEC and perhaps a successor to it that cleans up some of the problems it has. Where do you go? How do we get out of this mess in a long-term way as opposed to continually patching things that don't work?
If I were the czar of this whole thing and I could whiteboard a solution and then everybody just had to do that, I would give you an answer that would sound very neat and clean, but since we know that's not the situation and we have an installed base that numbers in the billions, we won't be discarding the idea of clear text DNS on UDP port 53 that is compatible with PDAs that were made 10 years ago and whose companies are out of business and are not here to patch them. So what we have to do is create a system that has, you know, reasonable fallback, but has a good ending state where you don't have to negotiate to do the new thing. You only have to negotiate if you're forced to do the old thing. We did a little bit of that with eDNS. We've done a lot more of that with DNSSEC. I will tell you that the last mile would be secure right now, even if you didn't have full DNSSEC to the PDAs, because DNSSEC gives you transaction security as an option using something called SIG0. We could also have this with Datagram TLS. We could have this with the T-key and the T-sig. There are a lot of different things that could be done. We're going to push all of them. And what I can tell you what I hope will happen, but I'll also had better tell you what I think is going to happen. I hope we can just do DNSSEC, because I've spent a long time working on that, and I hate it, but it's grown on me. But what's going to happen is that we're going to make as much progress as we can in every one of these areas, and one of them is going to catch on, and the other ones are going to fall by the wayside. I think that DNSSEC is going to catch on in the 3 to 5 year time frame, but in the short term, we're going to be pulling a whole bunch of ugly little tricks like DNS OX20 out of our pockets and using those along with UDP port randomization. So we're going to be doing a lot of ugly stuff between now and then.
So just a quick comment on that. I'd heard in the context of the exploit that there's a quote, I'm paraphrasing and mangling it, that technicians pay attention to key space and security professionals pay attention to economics. And in this particular case, the people who need most to work on DNSSEC deployment are those who have zones at risk, reputation, brand. But the people who need to support that do not have that same incentive and, in fact, are in a commodity death spiral in offering services to customers. And in fact, there are economic incentives to not deploy DNSSEC based on domain rewriting. So I think what will come about is, having witnessed in the last couple weeks interest in DLV, you know, interest in DNSSEC as opposed to rapid deployment, that we're going to have to come up with something that has financial incentives behind it as opposed to merely, you know, security implications behind it.
There are a couple of IDS rules that actually can detect successful cache poisoning. We've experimented with where you look for multiple responses to the same transaction ID with different value. There's a couple of bogus servers out there that will send multiple responses with different values, but for the most part, this appears to be reasonably robust. We get on the order of a couple of false positives, not dozens plus. You could also do this in the DNS server itself, hold state for a second or two on an open transaction. Even if you're dealing with 10,000 transactions a second, 2 seconds worth of state, you can probably live with. One other thing, however, that's disappointing me in this discussion is discussion of glue acceptance policies. That the question is, even if an attacker has complete knowledge for packet injection, Can you minimize the amount of damage that he can do? And one of the important minimizations seems to be never accept anything in the cache other than the primary record you're requesting. And so one thing in this discussion is that seems to be the elephant in the room that people aren't talking about.
We are talking about it. It turns out to be controversial. A lot of people's business plans kind of depend on being able to send you, for example, a full CNAME chain in the answer section, but you really can only accept the part of the answer that matches the question, and you have to iterate through the rest of it. And that's going to cause certain people's query rates to go up and their delays to go up and so on.
If the choice is between performance and security, yeah, which choice should we make?
Well, again, each person will wish to make that choice differently, but I think we're going to see more iteration and less taking of things that were not obviously asked for. Now, we've already got a fair amount of protection around glue. I'm embarrassed that Bind9 is still willing to answer a question using data it originally heard in the additional data section. That's bad, and I'm pushing on that, but that's controversial, it turns out, because that will make certain data disappear that was only available that way. And so it's not always up to the implementer to sort of drive that bus. There is a standards process. They are talking avidly, I can tell you, about the issues you're discussing. And ISC is in that standards process, but we can't get too far ahead of it or people accuse us of trying to take over. Bind is the 800-pound gorilla, and I don't want people to start being afraid that ISC is making them take things that the standards community hasn't approved of.
Dan?
Dan Wallach, Rice University. My question concerns the ability to extend existing DNS. I've just been reading up on this, so there's this.
Can you speak up? It's hard to hear
you. Okay, sorry. So my question concerns the ability to extend existing DNS. Right now, packets, I guess, have to be 512 bytes, but you can send bigger UDP packets than that. If you just tack stuff on at the end, is that going to break old things? And is that, could you shoehorn in more bits somewhere, somehow?
It's your RFC.
It's my RFC.
It's his turn, but it's my RFC. There's an RFC out there called eDNS 0, Extended DNS Version 0, where you can negotiate that in one packet, and it's opportunistic, and it's spoofable and so forth, so it's not good for carrying security information like extended query IDs, but it's absolutely common now to send 4K mobigrams full of DNS answers. And so we have been trying to extend the protocol. And it's a sad thing for me that when we were doing that, we didn't realize the need to extend the query ID and have certain kinds of fallback not be spoofable. That would have saved us quite a bit in this instance.
But I guess the question then is, since you have the ability to send larger packets, could you just by fiat say that we're going to start, everybody's going to agree that we're going to have some field in there, and we're going to all, if you don't see it, you'll ignore it or something like that?
The important part of your question is everybody's going to agree.
Earlier there was discussion about NAT and the firewall surprise that we're dropping flows. In some cases, the PICs of the world will start to drop anything greater than 512 bytes, and there's a certain amount of hardware that's been deployed that has assumptions about sizes. I think that will be implicated in some of EDNSO's uptake and adoption.
Okay. Steve?
Yes, Steve Bellow in Columbia University. It's more of a comment. DNS is a classic example of why you need to design security in from the beginning, because you can't just bolt it on. Packet size was right in 1983 when Paul Makapetris did it. One of the many reasons DNSSEC has been so hard is because of assumptions made in 1983, which just aren't very compatible with wanting to have signed objects they can pass around, query these many, many things. It was designed in a more innocent age, and you can't fix it easily. My answer to Dan's question is no, you cannot just send this. The spec says 512. People implemented it.
Hello. As I understand, for this attack to work, you need to have recursion enabled. And recursion is not supposed to be a good idea in DNS servers. I mean, many people say that it should be turned off by default. So why is recursion, why can't people just turn off recursion? If recursion is not, that this attack won't happen, as far as I understand.
If I might amend your question, if you were asking why is open recursion turned on, why is anybody allowed to use your recursor, that certainly is a very good question, and in all but a few cases you could ever think of, it should be turned off to the outside world. But you internally will need a recursor that understands the zone hierarchy, can find delegation. You absolutely need to be able to set RD bit traffic to find anything. So if you're talking about open recursion, exposing your DNS server to the wide world makes the attack trivial. But even if you have your DNS server hidden, there are ways to force an initiator to begin asking questions on your behalf that don't require direct interaction with the DNS server. So I would ask that you maybe give Dan Kaminsky a chance to explain a little bit more about that, or if you'd like to talk to me offline, I can give you an example or two that'll get you thinking.
Okay. Because what I found was that, I mean, when I tried to just query some servers outside, most of them were recursive, and you could actually launch an attack from anywhere you want because they're recursive. So as a part of one of your remedies, if that is a remedy, why not? It's an easy remedy.
I think open recursive servers were before a public nuisance, and now they're a public health crisis. So I agree with that part of your question. Yes.
All right, next question.
Hey, Eric Osterweil, UCLA. First of all, I want to thank you guys for having this panel. I think this is really cool, and so you'll get applause at the end, but you definitely deserve it. So I run a DNSSEC monitoring site, and I guess I have more sort of like a lob to the panel as opposed to a question, which is sort of a clarification on when you say DNSSEC won't necessarily be helpful for the next few years. I wonder, just to sort of keep the adoption spurring, because I think we see a big uptake in the number of people in the last few days that have started basically registering for monitoring. In other words, they're deploying. I don't think you want to be misconstrued at all as saying, like, it's not going to be useful, so stop deploying. So maybe just clarify maybe why it will be good now and how it'll get better again.
I hope one of the next papers you write describes the rate of interest before and the rate of interest afterwards so that we can characterize the effect that Kaminsky is having on driving DNSSEC adoption. So, you know, we may need two Kaminskys, maybe three. We need to know that number.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I guess maybe I should have thought of that. Yeah.
I want to add that since that was my comment, I agree it could be misconstrued. And I want to make sure everybody understands. I think we could see opportunistic deployment of DNSSEC as early as now. I'm using DLV. Anybody else who's using DLV is able to validate my records, even though my parent zone.com does not have any sort of DS records in it for me. So we've got this working.
Paul, could you quickly give an explanation of DLV?
Okay.
I don't think everybody knows what it is.
We've got it working. So deployment has begun opportunistically. And what I to clarify my remarks when I was at the podium, I really mean that if this Kaminsky thing had happened 3 years from now, it would have been a non-event because it just wouldn't have worked, because I think in 3 years we're going to see such wide deployment of DNSSEC that this kind of thing just couldn't happen, 16 bits or no. But we can't count on DNSSEC this year the way that we can count on UDP port randomization. There's just no way to get enough of the DNSSEC infrastructure deployed fast enough to stop Dan from talking at Black Hat. So that's why we went with what we went with. So I don't mean to say that DNSSEC can't be useful. It's useful for me right now. DLV, I was asked about DLV. It's DNSSEC look-aside validation. The idea originally came to me through David Conrad, who heard it from Sam Wheeler. So it's not my idea, but I'm the poster child for it because I've been pushing it. What we do is we accept people's zone keys in an alternate hierarchy. Ours is, of course, dlv.isc.org. And if you are trying to do DNSSEC in your validator, and you've reached the point in your logic tree where you're about to give up because you didn't get a key from the guy's parent, the last thing you can do, if you choose to, if it's optional behavior, before you give up, is to ask us if we have the key. And if we do, then you can try and validate his records, his signed records, using the key that you got from us. We do some work to validate that the person who gave us the key is authoritative for that zone and is not just inserting it because they want us to help validate the other version of bankofamerica.com, but not the real one. So we do some homework there, not as much as the .com people could do. So we really want them to just sign .com with DNSSEC and so forth. We want everybody to sign. DLV should be a temporary deployment aid. But it's out there, and it works right now, and there is a community of people that send their keys to us, and then they authenticate their ability to speak for those keys, and then other people who subscribe to our DLV tree are validating DNS data right now. So if you're interested in that, contact me, and I'll tell you more.
One example of an application that relies on DNS being accurate is OpenID. Does anyone know if someone has looked into this? It looks broken to me, but I can't find any discussion on the internet and any discussion of what to do to fix it.
If OpenID does not include its own sort of end-to-end security in its payload, in the DNS payload, then there's going to be a huge problem. However, speaking as a company, we're a small company who's been trying to overhaul our website for a couple of years now, and OpenID is on the whiteboard, and we're discovering that it's something we have to have, but that it's not exactly a world-dominating technology at the moment. So if it is vulnerable, it's probably not going to cause the same headache as DNS itself being vulnerable.
Do we have any more questions? If you have questions, please step up to the microphone.
I think, if anything, OpenID should be more vulnerable because even though OpenID didn't specify how you authenticate to the OpenID server, but the most implementations rely on username and passwords, right? So the phisher just needs to phish the OpenID server, and he gets access to all the other things, the authentication to all the other websites that you might visit. So if anything, I think OpenID amplifies the DNS of this DNS vulnerability.
Are you saying that the password is in the DNS query?
No, I'm talking about if you are redirected, when you are redirected to an OpenID server, and if the DNS has been compromised. So you went to the official website.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
David, do you want to say something about that?
So here's a useful exercise. It would be, I think, quite useful for this community to think through the various authentication mechanisms, architectures for deploying secure credential handling, and look at where DNS queries are made, and consider that right now, within seconds, the fundamental assumption about a name mapping to a known IP address is now completely violated. And I'm not familiar with OpenID's handling in this case, but certainly, without knowing the details, certainly a man-in-the-middle attack is something that should be considered as a possibility, unless there are other keys or a TCP component that you could start to rely on again.
Yeah. My question is very simple. My name is Wolfgang Schwabel. I'm working as a security manager for a telco. And it's always a funny experience for me when I visit such a conference, a security conference, because afterwards, when I leave, something I suppose to be secure isn't secure anymore. And it's always the same when I leave this conference, I know that the RAM, the DRAM is not secure anymore, I know that the DNS is spoofed and whatsoever else. I don't want to be provocative, but my question is rather simple. Is it really such bad if DNS can be poisoned? We know already that you cannot trust phone numbers. If somebody calls you and you see a caller ID, you cannot trust. If somebody sends you an email and has an email address, you cannot trust. Now, if you are connected to a website, okay, you cannot trust. So we have to invent other mechanisms of trust.
I think you're correct in pointing out some of the fallacy of the assumptions. The number of people who have come to trust, nonetheless, is clearly in the billions of people, and the amount of commerce tied up in that trust, without having measured this in any way, I could believe a trillion. I think that's the motivation for the need to think through better trust mechanisms. The usability problems that these present, I think, have made the current situation we're in somewhat inevitable because we did not have a usable alternative in time when it was needed. So that combined with the idea of building security in inherently from the beginning, from the design stage, I think is the most fundamental lesson that we should take from this.
I want to agree with that, but to me, the fact that trust has inertia and that we have a long way to fall if we're going to tell those billions of people that they have to stop trusting this, that's actually very difficult. That is so difficult that it is easier to contemplate DNS security than it is to contemplate getting people to stop trusting these answers.
If you take the 7-second best case that you gave, I don't know if that was one computer. You know, if you multiply that by 64K, you get 5.3 days. So are you relying on IDS to stop this attack? Because, I mean,
Yes. Essentially,
right.
Yes.
As I suggested.
And that IDS has to be, that IDS has to be somewhere in the path between the requesting server and the SOA, right?
Well, right now there's a class of IDS that send email as their behavior, often to me, you know, certainly whether you're in line or looking at a span, passively looking at data is part of the various architectures that the IDS community is familiar with. Going in line means you have deployment issues, you have a lot of QA that has to be done if this is something that people are going to be using realistically. And my comments earlier about the need for the IDS community to step up to this challenge, I think are in your question. Yes, they do have a role to play. They do have a lot that's very relevant to the DNS service. As much as I learned about DNS through Paul, I hope that being more familiar with IDS, there's a lot that can be offered from this community. So you don't have to be in line. You can look passively, but that means that your options would require somehow some granular access to cache lines, some ability to restart or stall or re-self-poison. There are no good, simple answers if you're not in line, but the prospect of going in line means that very few people may adopt you right away.
I want to add, there is a device in the path that is likely to be upgraded to include some IDS, and that is the name server itself. Somebody on the Nanog mailing list this last week or so asked if maybe we should open a couple hundred extra listeners to make every recursive name server into its own private little honeypot so it would know when it was being attacked. We have not had time. We've been running as fast as we can the last 6 months since February, trying to get done what we've got done. We have not had time to think about that kind of strategic adaptive response in the name server, but you can bet Bind is going to sprout features like that because we're already in the path and we've already got the state.
With DLV, which major resolvers currently support doing that for every check? And what is the consensus right now among them on what to return? You know, if you do see spoofing, do you return NX domain, serve fail? I mean, what do you do in that case?
As far as I know, the only recursive name server that is also a validator that can do DLV as its last chance validation before giving up on that is ours, is Bind itself. So you need to run LWResD or something like that. As far as what we return, it's entirely opportunistic. If we have an answer that we can't validate the signatures on because we can't find the key, then what we would normally do is just return it anyway. So really we have to find a signature that we can't validate because the key is wrong or the signature is wrong, or we have to find something where we know that a key should exist. DLV tells us there should be a key and there isn't. Or, you know, there are no signatures, but there is a key. What am I doing? So there are some additional failure conditions where, in that case, we would return serve fail, I think, is the answer. Unfortunately, nobody really knows what to do with that. They tend to retry it, and then it gets to the root servers and so on.
So, Simpson Garfinkel, what you've described seems really bad, and there's huge amounts of infrastructure that rely on DNS. And if it's so easy to do this attack, and if the bad guys...
Can you speak up a little bit, please?
If it's so easy to do this attack, and if the bad guys know how to do it, how come we're not seeing more of it?
We're seeing plenty of it. And the scenario I illustrated involving MX redirection interception is being seen on a large scale. Whether and how much email is falling into those traps, you can't characterize without access to the proxy servers. In some respects, DNS poisonings often tend to be crimes with few witnesses. You have to be the user themselves who looks things up. There are very few opportunities to do logging and recording of that data, SIE being the noted exception. And so being witness to those attacks is difficult. Often they're simply described as phishing. Perhaps it was a virus that was doing this or a bot that was forcing the behavior on the user client. But in terms of the attacks in the wild, there are plenty going on right now.
Did you want to add anything?
Okay. I'm Nicolas Swisborski from Qualys. So in the case of a corporate environment, if wouldn't be a solution being to use force all users to VPN in when they come from outside the corporation to guarantee that DNS is resolved inside the company by non-recursive, outside-facing recursive name server? And wouldn't adding diversity in multiple name server improve the security for the user?
So using VPNs for this kind of thing is supposed to be in itself a game ender. Right, a lot of corporate travelers, when they go to a hotel, the only way they can read their emails is if the hotel doesn't block their VPN and so on. So that tends to work, but you have to be a high-end traveler before that will work. And a lot of people are at the mercy of the internet cafe's recursive DNS. Now, the ways that you can test to find out if you're random, use the web. Usually, you know, the OARC people, Duane Wessels, has got a website that you can visit, and it'll tell you how random you are and which name servers you used. But if I was an attacker, that'd be one of the first things I'd poison. So my next thought was, well, you know, I don't know how to write Win32 executables, but David does, and, you know, we can get people to do that. Maybe we just need to make a tool and ship it to people, and they can run it on there. But then I thought, do we really want to teach people that they should download executables from the web and run them?
No.
So finally, I've come to the conclusion, and I'm going to ask Apple and Microsoft to do this because they more or less own the desktop on this planet, to please include a tool like that in the next Windows update and the next Mac OS update that turns your screen background blood red if your recursive name servers fail this test, or something like that. And you know, it's lame, but it's all I can think of.
Just another point on the trust, on the management of the trust for DNSSEC. Is an issue very similar to SSL and people that, and the maybe, the site may be non-verified, the people that go through anyway?
In the case of SSL, when you get one of these certificates, it tells you who it's been signed by. There's an opportunity to then decide, gee, do I know any of those, or do I have a path of trust that could lead to those? It's a graph theory problem. In the case of DNSSEC, you don't get to do that. You're signed by the key that is at the apex of your zone, which is signed by its parent and so on. And so you don't see the same kind of web of trust that you could get from X509.
All right, we have time for one quick question. We're already over time a little bit.
Is this something that only affects the DNS recursive servers, or is this something that could potentially affect, like, caching resolvers on end host too?
The specific attack targets vulnerable recursive servers, it allows the attacker to alter labels that are cached at that recursor. Those labels were supposed to have been properly answered by the authority servers, who themselves don't necessarily have patching to do, in this case have monitoring duties to do, but whose zones and labels are no longer being properly resolved and answered in cache. So this is one of those scenarios where you have actually three, four parties, an attacker, an authority, and a recursor, and the fourth person comes along, the user. The user is always the loser in this scenario. You can say that the authorities, you know, are not affected by this, but in fact, they're now realizing that perhaps the drop in traffic that they're seeing is associated with people being redirected to other sites. But specifically to the technical aspects of the attack, it's focused on the recursors.
But it would work on a stub if you were patient and you were willing to live with the fact that they weren't going to remember your poison, and it could take you seconds or minutes to inject exactly one bad answer that they would only keep a short time unless they're a web browser with an internal cache.
Does this mean that DNS is writing checks your resolver can't cache?
All right, with that, let's thank our panelists.